found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show on LATalkRadio.com, Channel 2. We're live every weekday morning, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Pacific, and then later available to listen on demand, download at MariaSanchezShow.com and TheMariaSanchezShow.com. We are live. It's Wednesday, June 26th. Thank you so much for joining us. We have historic news today, this morning. The Supreme Court has ruled on some important measures for folks here in the United States and also specifically in California. DOMA, or the Defense of Marriage Act, they struck down that marriages allowed in states who were not getting federal benefits, who had been denied getting federal benefits, that can no longer be. So whatever that means, if it's allowed in your state for your union to be recognized, for you to marry the person that you love, then the federal government is not going to distinguish between that union and a heterosexual union. And then finally, the Prop 8 one, which is concerning the folks here in the residents of California, it's a little bit nebulous, but basically they're saying that the lower court ruling stands, meaning that Prop 8, which was a majority of the voters here in California voted for it, which is the defense, they're saying that marriage is between a man and a woman. It went to a lower court, and that court ruled that, no, that's not the case. So now it's basically what they're saying. It's kind of interesting. That's because it's subject to interpretation. But as of this moment in time, they're saying it's probably now up to Governor Jerry Brown and to State Attorney General Kamala Harris to enforce Prop 8, which they had been unwilling to do so. So it also created interesting bedfellows with this ruling. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the 5-4 majority, and he said that the private sponsors of Prop 8 did not have legal standing to appeal after Prop 8 was struck down by the federal judge in San Francisco. So one of the adages about California is, as it occurs here, it blows east. And that would be true with striking down interracial marriages. There was a ban in October of that was lifted in October of 1948, and that was a 4-3 ruling by the California Supreme Court saying that interracial marriage was able to be had. Now, an interesting side note to that battle, or struggle if you will, was that there was an interracial couple, Andrea Perez, who was of Mexican descent, but she was regarded as white by California law, and Sylvester Davis, who was black. Both devout Catholics wanted to get married. So they went to get their marriage license in 1947, and the county clerk refused to give them their marriage license. So they traveled out of state to get married, and when they came back to California, they risked the fact that they could be prosecuted because they were an interracial marriage couple. And California decided not to do that. They decided not to pursue that. So they found an attorney who sued the county of Los Angeles, saying it was on religious grounds because the Catholic Church had no problem marrying them. The Catholic Church was for marrying them. So the judge that heard that said, forget the religion, we're just going to make this an equal opportunity. So that is why in October of 1948, interracial marriages were allowed in the state of California. And it appears that in June of 2013, same-sex marriages are going to be allowed. So we're going to visit with Fred Balch. He is a frequent contributor to our program on gay rights. He's our gay rights correspondent. Spoke to him this morning and some of my other gay friends about this historic decision, and he's going to share with us. Hi, Fred. You're on the air and live with Maria Sanchez. Good morning. Thank you so much for
making
the time.
Hi, Maria. How are you?
I'm excellent. Tell us Give us a, before you tell us your reaction to the decision this morning, give our listeners the background of your life as a gay man and your life with Ben and your marriage and et cetera, please.
Okay. Well, I was married when I was, how old was I? I was 24 years old and was married to a woman for 16 years back on the East Coast. And after 16 years, I just wasn't happy. So, and I didn't know why. So, you know, we talked and we went through some therapy and we decided to divorce. I moved out to California shortly after that and went through a gruesome process of coming out to myself and then coming out to others. And then I met Ben on the internet. I was minding my own business in a chat room and somebody IM'd me. And so Ben and I met back in 2000. And he came over to visit and there was something very special about him. And so we developed a relationship, a very slow relationship, which eventually led to us moving in together. And we decided to have a domestic partner celebration. We decided to become domestic partners on September of 2008. Unfortunately, Ben had to have emergency cardiac test, and he needed someone to help make the decisions. So we moved the domestic partnership up to February, and we went to City Hall and took care of that. And I have to tell you, after we became domestic partners, there was such a shift in my perception of our relationship. It was outstanding, and the same for Ben. And several months later, the Supreme Court of the State of California decided that gay marriage in the state would be allowed. So we decided instead of having a domestic partner celebration, we had a wedding on the same exact date we were going to have this celebration, which you attended, Maria.
Mm-hmm.
It was just an incredible evening, not just for us, but I recall during the wedding that we were so taken of the fact that what would be the likelihood of us. Ben was born in Havana, Cuba, and he came to the United States, and, you know, he lived in Las Vegas, and I was born in New York and came to California. Somehow we met, and somehow we decided we wanted to have a certified relationship during the same time that marriage became available in California. It was as if all the stars aligned. And I remember during the wedding ceremony that we became so emotional that we had to stop, and because we were swelling up in tears because this was such an important part of our life and something that we had struggled so much to get to a point, because Ben and I were very active in the Prop 8 situation and very active in getting people to know us and understand us and seeing that we were just like them. And and then we turned to everybody that was attending the wedding and we saw that they were also welling up, so tissues went out to everybody. and after about 5 minutes, the wedding resumed. And it was really one of those very special nights. And Ben and I have been more than happily married for the past 5 years. The only issue that we had was that our marriage wasn't recognized on a federal level, and that had many issues that were attached to that. If I were to die before Ben, he would not get my Social Security. If I died before Ben and, you know, there was a transfer of the house, you know, he would have to pay taxes on it. We have to do 4 tax returns every year because we're required by the state of California to file married. We're required by the federal government to file single. And in order to get the single numbers, we have to do state single. So it was very long, involved, and very expensive process every year. We do have a home in Vegas. And because Ben and I were married and not simply domestic partners, it took 2 years and 2 attorneys, one in Las Vegas and one in California, to just get my name on the deed without having to pay additional taxes. So, you know, it's really been a struggle all the way around. As a matter of fact, Ben works for the state and is entitled, his spouse is entitled to full medical benefits. But I haven't taken the medical benefits because we would be required to pay thousands and thousands of dollars of tax on medical benefits that a straight couple who is married would not have had to pay.
On the federal level.
On the federal level,
right.
Yes, on the federal level.
Hey, Ben, so, make sure you keep speaking into the receiver because I know you're on a landline, but you go in and out a little bit.
Okay. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. So that is, we're sharing the perfect example of about how it's equal and non-fair. It's equal that you get
Correct.
To say you're married, but you're not being treated equally or fairly in the ramifications thereof.
It's not equal. It's not equal. It's similar and not equal.
Oh, similar. Very, yes. Thank you for making that distinction. Better use of the word.
It's not at all equal. When Ben and I travel out of the state, we have to carry our marriage license with us. Because God forbid something should happen and one of us is hospitalized, you know, and we're in a state that does not recognize same-sex marriage, either one of us would not be able to make decisions for the other.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a horrendous situation. So we were just emotionally taken this morning as we watched the court decisions unfold. And, you know, Ben turned to me this morning and says, I really never thought I'd see it in my lifetime. And Ben and I have this thing going. You know, I've always been very patriotic, and you know, particularly in my first marriage and all of that. And when I went from being married as a straight man and then coming out as a gay man, I actually saw the difference in how I was being treated as a second-class citizen. It was more apparent to me than perhaps you know, someone else who had, you know, had always grown up with the prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had said to Ben, you know, when the holidays come, we live in a community where everybody's flying their flags on the holidays. And I said to Ben, I just haven't got the heart to put up the flag, you know, when I know that we're being treated separately.
The flag of the United States of America.
But I go to the United States.
Not the gay pride flag.
That's correct. And I just didn't have it in my heart because it would have been such a conflict for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I turned to Ben this morning after following the proceedings, and I said, I think I have to go out today and buy a flag.
Yay. In time for the 4th of July.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know?
Independence.
So right. Yep. It means a lot. I mean, it really sanctifies that we are equal in every single standing as anybody else in these United States, and that that there is no more question that we are second-class citizen. It just doesn't exist anymore. We still have a lot to do. We still need to, you know, make sure that our community of brothers and sisters are extended the same rights and privileges in the future, and there's a lot of work to be done. But today's decision on DOMA was just literally landmark, groundbreaking, and you know, it's something that we never thought we'd see in our lifetime.
Well, and I just interviewed a woman yesterday who wrote a book, and she said somebody in the White House looks like me, and she's a black woman who interviewed regular, ordinary black folks, because she says when President Obama was elected, celebrities and athletes and, you know, well-known people. But she said, what about the common person? And 201, they all said that, too. Never thought it was going to happen in my lifetime. And because it did, it empowered them. If he can do it, then I can do it. And I would imagine that's going to be the same within the gay rights movement, that if this is possible, then anything is possible. And what I find interesting, Fred, and we've had these conversations over the years as we've talked about issues as they've come into the news, is that why heterosexuals are so against anybody else joining the institution of marriage, it's not like we've done such a bang-up job of it. It's not like this. It's this pristine, you know, immaculate, 100% sanctity institution, and we can't have anybody sully it. It's like you folks are fighting to get into this institution, which I think I've tried. I love it. I haven't been able to make it work thus far. I think it's lovely. It's like, come join us. The more the merrier. Maybe you can teach us some things that we haven't been able to figure out.
Well, I don't think there's anything that we have to teach, but what I can tell you is that Ben and I have such an appreciation, a daily appreciation for our marriage, that because we realized that this was something we may not have been able to have, where everybody else just takes it for granted that if they want to get married, you know, and they get divorced, our marriage is sacred. I even had somebody in my office come up to me a couple of weeks ago and say, you know, I have to tell you one thing. Of all the marriages I've ever seen, I've never seen anyone more in love than you and Ben. And that just meant the world to me. It just meant the world to me because we treat each other with absolute respect. We know that, unfortunately, we were one of the privileged 18,000 couples that were able to get married in that short five-month time frame back in 2008. But you have no idea how thrilled we are that we're going to be able to see our brothers and sisters also share the same happiness that we're sharing.
So my understanding was is that when Prop 8 got passed, that didn't make your marriage null and void. It just didn't allow others.
The supporters of Prop 8 did want all of the marriages invalidated.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court of the state of California refused to do that. And they gave them an example during the court hearings saying, what if we were to say that everybody that's under the age of 25 can no longer drive? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that means we have to pull all of the people off the road that were under 25. He said, would that be possible? And the attorney said, no, that wouldn't be possible because the federal government has different statutes. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court judge said, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was not going to invalidate because he said, these people are already in established relationships. They have families. They have property together. You cannot disrupt their lives. You know, they've already begun their start. So thank goodness our marriage was not invalidated. And I don't know how Ben and I would have taken had the reverse happened, that DOMA was not struck down today. I just don't know how we would have reacted. I think we would have been very disillusioned for a very long time and tried to put together the pieces of how we can live in these United States when we are not united as a group.
Now, Fred, so, how are you going to behave moving forward knowing that the DOMA has been rescinded? So are you now going to be able to be on Ben's health insurance and you won't be having to file four different tax returns? Is that really going to change?
Yeah, that's really a good question. Ben and I had to make the decision by June 5th, and we decided that we would give it a shot, and I enrolled in the insurance plan on the hopes that DOMA would be struck down. And I said it would be worth 1 year's taxes, you know, for the sake of taking a chance. And, so I am enrolled as of July 1st. I'm sure our income taxes will cost a lot less than it does now, because we'll only have to do two sets of taxes, not four sets. And but I have the comfort and the safety in knowing that if something should happen to me or something happens to him, that we're taken care of, that we have a Social Security, you know, that will transfer over to the other, that our property is secure, that if something should happen to one of us in the hospital, you know, we'll be able to make the decisions without toting our marriage license around with us. There's a lot of differences. And
you, as a gay man in a marriage that was sanctioned by the state of California, are directly affected by the DOMA. But folks that are gay that would like to get married, that the Prop 8 one is probably going to affect them more first, because they didn't have the opportunity to have the benefits that were denied you, but now they are going to be granted to you. So
that is correct.
Right. So you actually have tangible, finite, immediate results. Whereas other folks are going to, we're going to have to wait to see what Governor Brown does. You know, they're saying it could happen as soon as next month. It'll be interesting to see how quickly they act.
Yeah, I heard the governor this morning, and he said certainly by the end of July.
Oh.
So they said there's just some paperwork they have to clear up, and then they will move forward. But even more important, those couples that have children or wish to adopt children, this will make a very big difference in their lives. So it's only good that happened today. It's good for the community. It's good for the country. I think it will really, instead of separating us as people, I think it will unite us as people.
Well, you know, there's a huge gathering in West Hollywood. I think it's at 5:30 tonight. Are you guys going?
That's correct.
Are you? You usually
no,
do.
I'm going to have to be at work.
Okay.
But we will be there in spirit. We were there the night the Supreme Court, I guess it was 5.5 years ago, announced that equal sex marriage was going to be permissible. And we were there, and we ate the wedding cake, and mm-hmm. we just had a fabulous time. Uh-huh. Little did we know what was ahead for us.
Well, anything worth having is worth fighting for, and this today is
absolutely
a victory. And so thank you so much. I know you're in your offices, and you've got work to do, but thank you for being available to us. You're a long-time contributor to the Maria Sanchez Show, and you didn't know that we had revived it. We're in our 10th week now, so welcome.
Excellent. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Freddie. Appreciate your
all
time.
Right, take care, Maria.
You too. Congratulations.
Bye-bye.
Again. Bye-bye. Fred Balch, and speaking with us this morning about the historic decisions that the Supreme Court made this morning. Of course, I have opinions about subjects, and when it's somewhat volatile, I like to get both sides involved so that you can hear both sides of the arguments, like hydraulic fracturing or fracking. We've had two sides of every issue, and then now Senator Fran Pavlis, she's about the only one whose legislation is still live in Sacramento. She has agreed to visit with us next month to talk about it. So if you have a strong opinion that differs from this one about what happened this morning with the Supreme Court, I welcome your invitation to join us on the program, because I do believe that both sides should be heard. I happen to be a huge proponent of gay rights, so that my opinion's coming through. And so it's not my way or the highway, but it's I'm ebullient and joyful this morning. I've texted several of my gay friends. It was like, history is made. And they don't even live in the state of California. So as I said, what goes in California blows east, and today should be no exception. Now we are going to talk about some ways that we can help pay it forward on a very simple level. We're visiting with Scott Edward. He's with the United Blood Services. Scott, good morning. You're on the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me to come on.
You're welcome. We wanted to make sure, one of the things that we endeavor to do on this program is to try and give people moments so where they can give back to whom much is given, much is expected, to pay it forward, to be inspirational. And on a small level, the gift of blood does that, and it's not so small. So I am really glad that you've decided to join us this morning.
Sure.
And I know that summer is somewhat of a critical time for blood donations. So let's just go through the whole process and what it means and what you're looking for and how we can help.
Well, the one thing about the summer time is that we are dealing with trying to fit into people's schedules. And that's what makes it pretty challenging in the summer. There's a lot of activity going on. They want to, you know, they want to go visit places. They got family and friends coming in. There's great events and festivals kicking throughout all California. So that makes we're competing with that. There's a lot going on, and so trying to make sure that people realize that you know, taking that time to visit one of the blood centers, you know, throughout California, and give blood is still important. Don't forget us during that busy schedule. And so that's kind of the reason why we highlighted the summertime.
So tell me this too, because if there are people that have probably never done it before, and they might have certain reasons for it, or it could just be, you know, ignorance, and I don't mean that in a bad way, just that
sure.
they don't have the knowledge. What is giving a blood donation all about, and what's entailed, and how long does
okay.
it take, and what can one expect?
Well, it's gotten, you know, it used to be a really black and white answer to give that about 10, 15 years ago. But now, you know, we have so many options in which we can interact with somebody coming into wanting to help, but depending on what blood type there are and what the times they have and what they can do. But the basics is, you know, if you are 16 or older, you're able to donate blood with us here at United Blood Services. And each blood center organization has slightly different rules based on what their medical directors have decided. So for United Blood Services here in California, 16 or older, you can donate. With 16, you have to have parent permission. 17 and older, you don't have to have permission to come in. and you want to weigh at least 110 pounds. If you're younger than 23, you know, we do have some certain weight and height restrictions that we're concerned about. We want to make sure that we don't take too much blood from somebody donating to us. And so we're very cognizant of how we interact with a particular body type of the donor coming in. That's just a, you know, kind of one of those volume issues that we have to look at when we're collecting. And basically, we have other issues like, you know, are you feeling healthy? You know, there's issues about travel, recent tattoos or piercings. Have you recently been pregnant? Have you traveled to a malaria area? You know, and other factors that we're looking into as far as risk for HIV or other types of diseases. And
so, which, by the way, so Scott, I had that happen to me. I went to donate 2 weeks ago, and they went into my travel plans, and one of the countries I visited in November of last year precluded me. They said I have to be 12 months home before I can give. So I'm on the do not take from her list.
Yeah, and I'm guessing, not knowing the specifics, and but I'm guessing it was a country with malaria risk is what keeps us really nervous, just because of how easily malaria spreads with mosquitoes.
Even though I got all the inoculations years ago, because I went to Africa in 2008, and that was a whole battery of things that I had to do over a period of time, and then even a booster a year later.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't even go into it. It was just like, oh, you went to these countries? No, we can't. And I was, you know, I was bummed that I couldn't give, but I totally understand. I would rather you err on the side of caution.
Yeah, and that's some of the things that admittedly does frustrate some of the people that want to donate, and is that we have very broad and err on the side of caution rules and guidelines. And so the whole idea is creating a guidelines that is very, very comprehensive, and we're going to err on the side of caution. And you know, if we had a doctor that could evaluate every single person, and we had like a team of 30 doctors and that was talking to every single person, then we could make allowances and we can dive into, you know, the details. But because we don't have that type of a system, we have to have these very broad rules.
That's fine, and I'm glad we're having this conversation,
because
the other thing that I think people don't realize is it doesn't hurt. It's a prick, basically, right?
Yeah, you know, okay, so I've been doing this since mid-90s, and you know, when I used to donate when I talk with folks, there is a finger prick at the beginning we use to test the hemoglobin, and then there's actual draw itself. And so there is a moment of discomfort, but honestly, the thing that causes the most pain in people's minds is all the questions that we ask. And we ask a lot of questions.
Uh-huh.
And because we have to go through the medical history, the history of somebody's background, and we really want to make sure it's safe for the donor to donate, as well as that there's any factors that could put a patient at risk. And that's been the number one thing when we talk to our regular donors. It's just, is there a way that you can just streamline the questions?
And then the other thing is that it doesn't take that much time. It's like, what, 10 to 15 minutes max to
well,
pull it?
Well, the whole process, the whole process takes about 45 minutes to an hour. The actual draw itself is about 10 to 15 minutes.
Right.
And so I wanted to make sure I'm clear on that. And then there's, you know, we have other specialty type of collections going on. If you're a platelet donor, now if you're somebody that's, for a lot of personal reasons, people decide they want to get into donating platelets. If you qualify for that, that's a targeted component of blood that you're actually sitting at a medical device and withdrawing only the platelets from somebody, and that helps majority of cancer patients, but also some surgery and some other folks with their immune system that are suppressed. And those folks are sitting there for 2 to 3 hours is the whole process.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And they can donate up to 24 times a year, so your body produces platelets more rapidly. And it's actually one of the things behind the scenes that keeps us on our toes, because we only have 5 days in which to transfuse those platelets. And so that's a category of blood donation that we don't talk too much about, unless we have, you know, a little extra time to talk about it.
My dad is receiving platelets regularly. He had open heart surgery last year, and his the counts plummeted. In fact, he's still getting them. He was down to 14,000 just last
week. Oh, wow. Wow, yeah.
Talk about
example.
The gift of life. And that's kind of something else that we wanted to emphasize is that United Blood Services, you aggregate the blood and then you disseminate it in the area or wherever the need is greatest, or how does it work from donor to recipient?
Oh, sure. So we collect the blood and we divide it into different components. And so one donation, depending what type of donation these days, whether it's a double red cell where there's a process of giving us two red cells, or if it's a red cell and it's called a jumbo plasma, or if it's just a whole blood donation, which is traditional, we can actually break it down into, multiple components. And once we've broken that down, we have, distribution centers, in California, and we have some sister centers in Northern California, and we work together to make sure we have the blood ready to go into the hospitals. And so the hospitals we serve go specifically for United Blood Services California, cover from Monterey all the way down into LA. We have quite a number of hospitals that we serve in LA as well, and that whole region, you know, keeps us busy and managing the blood supply, making sure we have the right mix of O negative and O positive and Bs and on the shelf, keeps us on our toes. The need is substantial enough that we do have our UBS centers in other states that we do have fly in special needs or rare blood types, or a lot of times it's O negative that we need. And so it's a big operation behind the scenes.
So if somebody doesn't know their blood type, that shouldn't preclude them from donating. And also, if you don't live in the state of California, these systems are in place throughout the United States, at least.
Right. Okay. So yeah, you will get the quickest way, a few days after you donate, it's going to be available online. Over the past couple of years, we've really become a sophisticated online operation where you can even, with our system, jump on and see what your cholesterol count was when you came in. And we're also, with the implementation of a new computer system a few days ago, we'll be able to have someone's wellness history. When they came in, you know, what was their reported weight and the temperature and all those things that we take during the mini physical when they come in, we'll actually are recording that and making that more available for the UBS California donors.
Wow. So that's added value.
Yeah, and that's been happening with the other UBS centers outside of California. Mm-hmm. And since now we changed into this new computer system, we can join our sister centers.
Go ahead. Because I was going to talk about the health benefits for the donors. There are some, in other words, as if this wasn't enough of a win-win-win.
Right. Well, this is where I have to be careful, because I can speculate on what I've been told, but there's nothing that we're going to claim as for certainty. But we can go through some of the studies that have been, you know, since I've started working with blood centers. There's two topics. The donors come to me and talk about when you donate blood, your, you know, cardiovascular health improves. And there's two categories: males over 40 and you know, females after menopause. And the whole concept with that is it reduces the level of iron in the blood. And the theory is that amount of iron reduction just helps reduce the chance of a heart attack, because of a theory of built up iron levels in the arteries. And I know I'm using very layman terms. I'm sure there's somebody listening that's probably pulling their hair out because I've simplified it so much. But that's the theory behind one of them, is that it could help with cardiovascular health. And then, but there are some real stories that I've encountered over the years with regular donors where they would come in and were routine blood donors. We would see them 4 to 6 times a year. And one time, one of our longtime donors, just something was off. He couldn't donate that day, which was unusual. And it was so unusual that he's like, I got to go see my doctor. And he was able to find out there was something wrong with him in the early stages. This happened to be cancer that he discovered. But there's something that we detected early on. Now, that one is, you know, you can't make that that claim that,
right.
But it was a real story of some of us just, you know, because they're involved and always monitoring their health, and you know, donating blood is one way you can keep monitoring. And so there's those types of stories that we have out there.
And then finally, Scott, in terms of donating, you say 4 to 6 times a year is okay, but you're shooting for a goal of roughly 3 times a year of the folks that you'd like to solicit?
Four to six was max. We have kind of the average donation is if somebody donates maybe once a year, a little over statistically, it's like 1.2, right? But so we put a challenge out there for people to, if they could donate 3 times a year, and if the people who are eligible to donate and who are healthy enough to donate and have the time, that if that number got to at least 3 times a year, that would give us enough of a variety of all the different blood types and the components that we can avoid shortages throughout the year.
And Scott, your website?
UnitedBloodServices.org. And there's a wealth of information there. Depending on which states you're accessing it to, you can click on our map, and it will guide you to the nearest blood center.
Thank you so much for your time, and I'd like to visit with you in the fall to see how your campaign went, if you will.
That would be great. I appreciate it.
Okay, Scott, thank you so much. I really do appreciate the messaging. And Scott Edward with United Blood Service. And we're going to shift gears again, and this is about a national story. The 10-year-old girl who got the adult lung transplant. Well, she was in the news yesterday again because she's come out of the coma that they induced her into, the medically induced coma, and her mom was posting on Facebook about what's laying in front of her in terms of her recovery. A lot more pain, she says. Tough 24 hours. We are weaning sedation and some pain meds to make Sarah more awake in preparation for extubation, but she is in a lot more pain. It's such a big thing for such a little girl, but we know she can do it. So they also speak about how this 10-year-old girl was, you know, on death's door, and there was the issue that you could only get a lung transplant if you were younger than 12 from a child donor, and that got changed. And a lot of it was through social media. So that made us, we interviewed last week, One Legacy, which is all about organ donations. And now we have Pablo visiting with us. He is a liver recipient, and Pablo is going to speak with us about his journey through getting his donation and what that's been like. So we're calling him at work, because people are at work, obviously. And if we don't get him here, we've got his cell phone number.
Thank you for calling Dr. Tony Hong's office. How may I help you?
Hi, is this Pablo?
It is.
It's Maria Sanchez, and you're live on the Maria Sanchez Show. Pablo Saucedo, a liver recipient, and I understand today is the 3rd anniversary of the recipient?
That's correct.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's a wonderful day for sure.
How fabulous. So, Pablo, I was telling our listeners that you were going to share with us your journey about how you came to need a liver and how it is that you got one and how what that whole process was like for you. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Yes, back in February of 2010, I had a follow-up physical with a doctor, and he said, there's something really wrong. We got to do some tests over again. And so he gave me a call, and he's like, come on in, and there's something wrong with your blood test. We have to do it again. So let's schedule something for next week. Well, maybe like 2 days before my appointment, he calls me up and says, meet me at the emergency room. And I said, what? So we meet up at the emergency room, and he says, yeah, you have liver failure. I don't even know how you're alive. So, you know, you go from a physical to that. I don't have the words. It was just.
How old were you, Pablo, at that
I'm
time?
I'm sorry?
How old were you then, 3 years
I
ago?
I was 38.
38, so you're young. And were you having
healthy
jaundice? Or?
I had jaundice. My skin was yellow. I had a little bit of jaundice. But I thought it was just fatigue. I was working 2 jobs, so I thought it was just, you know, just myself, just overworking myself, you know, and fatigue and what have you. So that was my initial visit to the doctor for the jaundice.
Mm-hmm.
And then turned from that to to need a new liver. And while I was at the emergency room, I remember the doctor telling me, you know, you have an HMO insurance. I don't think they're going to cover a liver. So, again, another blow, and I'm like, oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, my wife and I are looking at each other, like, and he says, I'm going to send you to my friend at UCLA. So that's where the ball started rolling in terms of me getting on the list. I got on. It took me about 3-4 months to get on the list.
Wow.
Once I was on the list, I was very fortunate. I was only on the list a couple of weeks, but from that initial news that I needed a liver to, you know, getting insurance coverage, to, it was just like an uphill battle with the doctors and the insurance company and everything. So, yeah. I mean, that's how that got started.
So the surgery was in June of 2010?
Yes, it was June 25th, and then went all the way through the 26th. It was an 11-hour surgery.
Oh my goodness!
Yes, it was intense.
And what was your recovery like?
The recovery was, I felt like a truck ran me over.
Uh-huh.
But I was young and healthy, so I was strong. I was in the hospital on a Friday and I was out on a Friday. I always had the positive outlook that I was going to be fine. So, you know, my rehab was pretty quick. It was a few months afterwards where I was like up and running around. So.
And what is the post-surgical follow-up like in terms of your health and wellness and managing that, the recovery?
Well, you know, right after the surgery, for the first few months, you're at the hospital once a week getting blood work done, making sure that the liver doesn't, that your body doesn't reject the new liver. So from there, you graduate to once a month, and then from once a month to twice a year, and that's where I'm at right now.
And they're looking for enzymes or rejection issues?
Right. Just they're making sure that my body's not rejecting it. Of course, I'm taking medication for that as well. But that's the main thing, is looking for the enzymes not to be too high and out of whack and stuff like that.
And Pablo, do you know anything about the liver that was donated and the person that it came from?
I know very little. I do know that it was a young person. It was a 23-year-old female, and they were from Southern California. But other than that, I don't know much. I did write him a letter. I wrote him a letter and to the family, and you know, hoping to meet them. But I haven't heard back from them.
And is one legacy involved with your liver?
Absolutely. The whole process goes through one legacy, through Donate Life. Yes.
And how did you become aware of that? Or are they partners with UCLA, and that's how you got placed in their care?
Right. They're partners with the hospital, so they're there for, for the donation part of the process when the opportunity presents itself.
Because I spoke with Elena last week, who does their communications, Elena de la Cruz.
Yes.
Because of this 10-year-old girl needing the lung transplants and what that's all involved, and then what it means to be an organ donor and all of that stuff, because I had some trepidation. I had done it earlier in my life, and I had stopped doing it moving forward, because I'm a real proponent of life, and I want to be hooked up to things because I'm going to come back. So I don't want people
right.
harvesting my organs before I'm ready to pass on. And so she, not only did she assuage me so much that afternoon I went in and I logged on, and now I'm an organ donor, and I sent that notice to my four children so that they know that you know, this is my will. So I've gone from being a doubter to now being a promoter.
Yeah, there's so many misconceptions as to the whole process, whether they're going to save you if you're sick or if you're in an accident or what have you. And there's a strict criteria for that. So the number one objective is always to save the injured or the sick person. So it's not like they're going to take your organs prematurely.
Well, and as she mentioned, the paramedics don't know if you're a donor or not. The doctors
don't
know. The hospitals
don't
know.
They have no idea.
Right. So it's not like somebody's behind the scenes lurking, waiting to strike so that, you know.
Right. And basically the criteria is if they pronounce you brain dead, there's no activity in the brain, then the process starts. But until then, I mean, they're going to do everything to save you.
So what does this mean to you and your wife and your family in terms of how you look at the world and at life?
Well, my goodness. Well, you know, I always think about those days prior to to me getting my new liver, my second chance at life, I was just so down. So it was just like you're almost like waiting to die, you know. Mm-hmm. And now that I'm 40 now, and I have my whole life ahead of me. I have two kids, two beautiful kids. I've already seen my son graduate from high school and move on to college. I've already seen my daughter have her 15th birthday, and you know, just so many blessings that have come my way. I'm so grateful now. My marriage is so much stronger. I can't even imagine. I spend more time with my wife during my illness than I have in the past 19 years that I've been married. So it's just been a blessing. You know, I know it's a horrible thing to go through, but I wouldn't change anything because it's made me such a stronger, better person. And I couldn't have done it without the donation process, you know. So I urge everyone out there to please, if you know you have any questions or any doubts, to contact Donate Live for One Legacy, or you can go on their website and sign up. You know, for sure, you can go to DonateLifeCalifornia.org and sign up. And if you're out of state, you can go to DonateLife.net and you know, sign up for sure.
And the one thing that Elena mentioned last week is that one person can actually save up to 8 lives, because there are 8 organs/tissue that may be available. So that, talk about the ripple effect.
Right, and I've already met people who received, you know, kidneys and liver or lungs or heart, and then and not only that, not only the organs, but there's tissue and ligaments and other things. There's so many things that can be used, you know, that definitely make a difference in for people who are suffering or waiting or sick, you know. So.
And Pablo, you're considered an ambassador for the program, correct?
I am. One of the things that I really wanted to do was give back. You know, my prayers were answered for sure. So one of the things I did immediately was to start looking for things to do to volunteer. So I volunteer at UCLA on Wednesdays. Today I'll be there for the support group to help with families that are waiting to receive their gift. And I also partnered up with Donate Life to bring awareness for organ and tissue donation. So yeah, I'm an ambassador to hospitals. I get to meet up with people and talk about donation.
Thank you so much for that. And that's how we got connected through One Legacy and Donate Life. I appreciate your time. Congratulations. Continued success. Long may you live.
Thank you so much. And again, a blessing to everyone and that prayed for me and everything else. And please sign up to be a donor.
Thank you. I couldn't agree more. Take care. Have a great day. Thank you for all you do. Pablo Saucedo, he received his liver 3 years ago today, the 3rd anniversary. So again, what prompted all of this, our chat last Wednesday, as a matter of fact, with One Legacy, and then our chat today with the ambassador, is this 10-year-old girl and the organ donations. And her mother started getting the awareness by signing up for the campaign on change.org. And change.org gets 30,000 petitions each month. And this petition that the mother started, again, the 10-year-old's name is Sarah Murnican. I'm butchering that, I'm sure. It started out with 10,000 signatures over Memorial Day weekend that eventually reached 370,000 signatures. It's in the top 1% of Change.org's petitions. So after Memorial Day, the politicians took interest. They asked the Secretary of Health and Human Services to make an exception, but they refused. So then a law firm came forward and offered its services for free. The firm started with sending a letter to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and then they went to court the following day. Earlier this month, a federal judge issued a temporary restraining order to prevent the Health and Human Services from enforcing the rule for Sarah by June 10th. The Organ Transportation and Procurement Network had reevaluated and made changes in the rule. And on Saturday, June 22nd, Sarah woke up after 9 days of sedation. She's expected to be taken off her ventilator and breathing on her own toward the end of this week. That just shows you how quickly things are unfolding. So we try to get good messages out there, to be inspirational, and to give you knowledge. So thank you so much for joining the Maria Sanchez Show. Have a great day. Looking forward to visiting with you tomorrow.